being required to sign off on work authorization to participate in the control of overtime, to participate more heavily and more often in program reviews, brought his capability into the forefront of the rest of the people that work in the division, and they soon began to recognize that a program manager had a job to do, had some authority with which to execute his task, and that the man did have the full support of the division general manager. So as these things did occur, we began to reverse the trend towards projectization. And I recall on the Saturn program where we had an organization known as Program Control, as well as the Missiles and Space Division Financial Management Department, which dealt in financial matters, that we merged these two organizations, gave them a common head, and kept a very small staff reporting to the program manager. Their job was to place the program requirements on the regular financial management departments and get the job done by people that were more centrally located. You might compare it to manufacturing facilities. It kind of stretches the imagination, but if there is a resource, in this case it's manpower, that understands the methodology of handling financial management matters, by putting them all in a central organization, a majority of them in a central organization, they become more flexible to accept work from other programs. One man can work on more than one program, and therefore total program costs begin to go down. Mm-hmm. We also begin to reverse the projectized trend in development engineering. And we had at the time here at Huntington Beach a development engineering organization that was devoted to the MOLE program, and a development engineering organization that was devoted to the Saturn program. And we combined these two organizations with the full agreement of the two customers, NASA and the Air Force, in order to more effectively move the people about to where the work was needed to be done. With the two separate organizations, Saturn Engineering and MOLE Engineering, the ability to transfer work among the people was a little less, or considerably less, than when you say you have one development engineering organization who do the engineering tasks for both the MOLE program and the Saturn program.
Didn't you begin to lose a little bit of the commitment that people in the individual program
had? Yes,
then?
Yes, because everything is not all black and white on either side of this. But operating costs again begin to go down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the programs benefit too from the fact that you can more readily exchange qualified people. There's a cross-fertilization of the ideas happen more readily.
Yeah.
And it was not a total sweep that says now everybody's in the same development engineering organization and no one is attached to MOLE or Saturn. There was heavy project engineering task forces left in being to retain that control and that interest.
Well, were there things left to give the program manager leverage more than he'd had before projectization?
The things that were left that gave him more leverage before that, then when he, let's go back and say it again. I think the thing that allowed us to deprojectize was the change in the management directives that control the operation of the division, their recognition of the program manager and his participation in the management of the program, the insertion of the man in the loop, in the operating systems, gave him more control than he had before these changes occurred,
mm-hmm.
and made him more effective.
Mm-hmm.
So the point here is that I think we've seen a cycle on the Saturn program. We started with a relatively few people in a program office. That was eventually projectized into large organizations reporting to the program manager. And now the cycle has gone back again to the small organization, and currently we're running the Saturn program with about 25 people, direct and indirect,
mm-hmm.
in the program office.
But there's still, you don't think has impaired the excitement that people felt being part of the program?
I don't think it's.
Or maybe, you know,
I don't think it has jeopardized it to the point that it it has to be the controlling thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the project organization certainly have the greater opportunity to get the esprit de corps going. Mm-hmm. But everything's a compromise, and
mm-hmm.
you're making trade-offs in the fields of program management and management techniques. This is the people in design make design trade-offs.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all one-sided. You must look for the ultimate better of the two ways and change.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can just briefly review this. About what time then again did you begin to projectize?
Okay, let's go back and pick up a few key milestone dates. The original Saturn contract occurred in 1960.
Yeah.
In August of 61, the Douglas Aircraft Company reorganized to provide an organization known as Douglas Missiles and Space Systems Division and
mm-hmm.
Douglas Aircraft Division.
Mm-hmm.
1962 was the advent of Skybolt, and we established the Skybolt subdivision with the strong encouragement of the customer in order to provide him confidence that we had control of the resources that would be assigned to his program.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 1962 saw the opening of the Saturn S-4B program.
Mm-hmm.
And it then opened in an atmosphere where projectization was encouraged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In 1964, the update of the management directive systems, the emphasis on the role of the program manager occurred.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I don't mean there wasn't any emphasis on his role before, but he began to be recognized in the operating systems of the division.
Mm-hmm.
1965, we were able to consolidate the financial management organizations of Saturn Program Control and Douglas Missiles and Space Systems Division Financial Management.
Mm-hmm.
In 1968, we were able to consolidate the engineering organizations of the MOLE program and the Saturn program. In 1969, all engineering organizations were consolidated into a single development engineering organization. As these events took place, the program office became smaller and smaller from a payroll basis. So I think we've seen a a cycle.
Did the program office's origination have anything to do with the way that Marshall itself was organized?
Yes, I'm sure it did.
Does it mean it was a counterpart?
We had to align ourselves with the customer's organization. Mm-hmm. We had to recognize his technical capabilities and establish a technical interface, as well as a contractual interface and the overall program management interfaces. Mm-hmm. And these were certainly strong influences on the organizational arrangement.
What about what time did the merger of with McDonald take place? Was that 68?
I'm embarrassed.
Well, there are a couple of phases it went through, I think. I can't remember exactly what it was.
There was only one merger, and it does have a date. I have the impression it was 67, but I would not want to be quoted without looking it up.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering, you know, what kind of impact that made on the program manager as it functioned at that time, although.
Well, initially, coming to work the next week, you really didn't recognize any difference. But as time has progressed, the desire to present ourselves as a single McDonnell Douglas Astronautics Company has caused organizational realignments with identifiable offices for such things as the Skylab program, space station, shuttle, Saturn, where an individual has an overview of not just McDonnell Douglas Astronautics Company West or East, but is able to look and act on problems from a full company viewpoint.
Was there much interchange of engineering staff when that consolidation took place? Were they because of the nature of the operations of McDonald's, say, in the fighter business, it was a different thing?
Well, now really, McDonnell Douglas Astronautics Company East had a lot of manned spacecraft experience, and we have drawn upon that. I'm not sure what we have drawn in the way of numbers, but they certainly were in the manned spacecraft division in St. Louis before we were here on the West Coast with the Gemini program.
Mm-hmm.
And as an example, the Skylab workshop program today is managed by Fred Sanders, who came to us from McDonald Astronautics Company East.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe there was large swings in the movement of engineering labor from east to west, or vice versa.
Well, looking at the diagram we have here, you've got to kind of allocate how much administrative support each of these program offices gets. Do I follow that?
Yes. Actually, it's doing a bit of planning on what they will need to stay in front of them, and then reacting to the unusual requirements as they occur on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Do you have things to say then, too, about the number of technical people that each organization is going to get?
Only the payroll organizations of the three program managers.
Uh-huh.
I control or help control their operating budgets, and there is a staff of technical people in each program office.
Yeah.
Very small. Uh-huh. But don't misunderstand that and assume that I control the number of engineers that work on the Saturn program. I don't.
No. Uh-huh. Again, when we get back to the technical side, that they used to get together with people from Marshall and literally, you know, hassle things out.
The working groups.
Yeah. Did you ever get into that kind of situation administratively?
No, I was aware of the fact that they were going on, and it was one of the recognized methods of resolving items that mutual interest with the customer.
Mm-hmm.
You might say the Saturn program had a story of success by virtue of review after review after review, the objective was to have no in-flight failures. Mm-hmm. The Saturn Apollo program could not afford that. So both the customer and ourselves recognized that oversights just had to be avoided. And so the practice of challenging the readiness of the stage by an independent agency was developed. We formed the organization within MSSD known as Vehicle Flight Readiness. And that organization's role was to play the devil's advocate.
Is that part of your office then, Vehicle Flight Readiness?
No.
It's just another parameter in there.
It's another organizational element of the division. Mm-hmm. To give greater assurance that the hardware was ready. Mm-hmm. And just as any outside inspector can find my specs or large spots, these people were professional. They went about their assignment with zeal. And we learned to work with them, respond to them, and I'm sure that they helped improve the reliability of the Saturn stage.
How large a group was this, do you recall?
Very small. I suppose that all programs handled by the Missile and Space Division probably ...15 to 20 people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the Vehicle Flight Readiness Department was somewhat organized along the program lines. They deliberately interchanged personnel to take advantage of the experiences from other programs on what might be soft spots.
Mm-hmm. What about the Apollo fire? Did that have any real impact on your planning here and your operations?
Yes, it obviously stretched the program out much longer than we had originally been scheduled to operate. Mm. And I don't know how you assess the real impact of such an event on the time frame or the additional cost or the additional safeguards that went into the program as a result of that fire, but certainly it had an impact.
Mm-hmm. It gave you more breathing space, I suppose, for one thing. You really get that hard-pressed to start with.
I don't think the booster stage was quite that hard-pressed, but whenever any program suffers a stretch-out, it suffers additional cost. Mm-hmm. It's just not logical that you can extend the program schedule by 6 or 12 months and not bear a financial impact.
Did you have very close relationships with your counterparts from NASA headquarters? Did you share information techniques?
With the local resident manager's office, yes. I don't think there is the same strong working relationship between the administrative types as there is between the technical types or the program managers. Mm-hmm. We have similar types of functions, but we are doing those chores for two different organizations that each probably want a little bit different degree and support and services.
Yeah. Well, I think that really kind of covers the thing here, but that there was a question about the the program manager business. Were the other contractors, to your knowledge, undergoing the same kind of thing, or was this unique to Douglas?
I'm sure they were undergoing the same thing. I can describe the Douglas area much better than I can the North Americans or the Grummans.
Yeah.
But program management as a concept and a philosophy was being developed during the 1960s in the United States and the major aerospace contractors. I'm sure each of them had similar problems in some areas and then a varying degree of differences.
Okay, well, we're trying to keep our, you know, time down, taking your time.
One from the inception is Dave Aldrich, A-L-D-R-I-C-H. Dave retired just about a year ago, and he lives Whittier, right? And Dave has given a number of speeches on the F1 development program and technological bases and major accomplishments required and things of that nature. And so in your travels, if you had an opportunity, it might be well to get with Dave. I'm a relative newcomer. I came on the F1 in program management in 1968. So Dave was on from the inception of the program. He was also involved in the E1 program, which was an experimental program out of Wright-Patterson, and was kind of the forerunner of the F1. And Dave, by the way, prior to that, was a program manager on what was called the REAP program, Rocket Engine Advancement Program. So was pretty familiar with what some of the advances had to be in the generation of a 1.5 million pound engine. So I would recommend that if opportunity presents itself, you might sit and chat with Dave. His assistant program manager throughout the course of the program was Dom Sanchini, S-A-N-C-H-I-N-I. Dom is still here at Rocketdyne and is directing the proposal activity on the space shuttle. And so he might be able to give you some more information on what he felt were some of the major accomplishments or areas of achievement. The J2 program, the original program manager was Walt Studhalter. Walt is still here, S-T-U-D-H-A-L-T-E-R. He's in the Combustion Devices Organization now, still at Rocketdyne, so he's available for comment. He was followed in the program management role by Norm Rule. Norm is presently the vice president of the liquid rocket programs. By the way, he's also vice president of the production operations. Unfortunately, he recently had a heart attack and is not in the plant at this time. But sometime in the future, you might want to check with Norm. He followed Walt Studhalter. He was followed by Paul Kastenholz. Paul is now the vice president of the space shuttle main engine activity and also is at Rocketdyne and available to you. And he was followed by Paul Fuller. The F1 case, again, was just Dave with Sanchini being his assistant, followed by me. Okay, in the engineering side of the house, Wilhelm was the senior project engineer on the J2 development, and he is presently on the space shuttle engine as the chief project engineer, I think his title is. So he's available to you. And then Paul worked for him, and when Willie moved on, Paul moved up to Wilhelm's spot. So that's the continuity there. On the F1, Ted Benham was the project engineer and then became the senior project engineer on F1. And then Joe is followed him. After Paul went into program management, as I mentioned before, Paul Kaufman was the project engineer on J. So those individuals, I think, might very well, depending upon how much information you get from us and how much more you need, you might consider those as a kind of a bibliography of who you need. Okay, maybe a little bit out of sequence, but since the information is available on what the engineering people consider the major configuration change points, why don't we take that as the first item of business? As this other information becomes available on the technological advancements required, we can bring you on board on that. Joe, you want to go through these? You're much more qualified than I. You haven't seen it either. Well,
these documents were prepared.
We're going to take a couple minutes and get prepared for what we're
If you guys don't mind, Paul and I will beg off a little bit. You can use the office here, make yourself comfortable, and these guys take you, and we'll be back shortly.
Okay.
but he now has full responsibility for all design phases of the systems organization for F1 as well as J2 and H1 for that matter.
And this is Lou Dietrich?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dietrich.
Okay.
All right. Let's go through the J2 first,
okay,
since I've got to be a little bit more familiar with that. The original concept of the J2 engine was one which utilized what we call tank head start characteristics. That is, it was hoped that the engine would start and progress into main stage without auxiliary sources of energy in terms of getting itself through the start transient. In other words, the only energy supplied to the engine would have been that energy delivered by the propellants at their normal tank head pressures. Because of the character of the engine, it turned out that simply was not possible. The biggest single difficulty was that the fuel turbopump, being an axial flow machine, would stall. And having stalled, then you weren't pumping any fuel through it, and the failure to pump fuel through the fuel pump resulted in all sorts of unpleasant ramifications, such as burnout of the thrust chamber and so forth. The solution to that problem was an engine-mounted start tank, and that's probably the biggest single obvious external configuration change that you noted in your review of the films. The first R&D engines had just a little bitty helium tank on them, and then the next ones, the ones that really worked and made it through in the main stage, went to the big tank.